Hello and welcome to the 42nd episode of the Loopcast. I'm here and very happy to have Kevin Bell. We're talking with him directly from Afghanistan, so if there are any technical difficulties, it's due to the long distance. But Kevin is an expert on Afghanistan and the Taliban, and we're very happy to have him on the show. So thank you for coming on, Kevin.
Thanks for bringing me on, Chelsea.
Today, we're going to have a look at the opening of the Taliban office in Doha and the interesting developments that have taken place with that. For those who have been following it, Taliban has wanted to join in on peace talks with the Afghan government and the U.S., and there's been a lot of interesting developments regarding this. They thought they were going to have peace talks earlier this week, I think it was early this week, but those have been canceled. So, Kevin, what are your thoughts on the developments and actually the Taliban opening this office in Qatar?
Well, first of all, I think that what we're seeing is, you know, when you have a major event like this where they open an office in Doha, you finally kind of get to see publicly some of the arguments that have been taking place behind the scenes for 6 months or a couple of years, depending on who you're talking about. And what you're seeing is that there's really not a lot of agreement about what needs to happen. You know, there's wide sense of agreement that whatever it means to say there's not a military solution to this conflict, that whatever that means to different people, many people seem to believe that. But at the same time, there's not really a good sense of what that leads us to do, right? So there should be some kind of political solution, but what does that look like? You know, if you start talking about power sharing, then you're going to find a lot of people in Central and North Afghanistan who get very, very upset about that. And if you start talking about actually having a political office, I mean, I think one of Karzai's several issues with the opening of the political office recently was that it had an appearance that was rather more like an embassy, rather more official than just an office where people could speak with the Taliban. And that's something that I think for obvious reasons, he found threatening, and, you know, and that's something that he expressed very clearly, you know. So, and on the U.S. side, we have the one soldier, Bo Bergdahl, who was captured by the Taliban and who's been in their custody for several years. I think it's been since 2009 at some point.
Yes.
I think right after I left here that he was captured. So the U.S. is hoping to get him back. But even on the U.S. side, there's not necessarily a lot of agreement about what role we should be playing in this, right? And I think that that's the thing that that makes Karzai very uncomfortable. He doesn't want to be on the periphery of these talks, and the Taliban are not in a position where they can, say, have a direct bilateral or even trilateral talk with the Karzai government. They're still running the line that, you know, this is a puppet government. We're not going to talk with them. We're only going to talk with these other powers who are really controlling them, things like that. So,
right, and I saw recently that the Taliban, or what's the word, I guess, would be to that they're anxious to do talks with the idea of exchanging the U.S. captive for, I think it's 5 Taliban members that are in Guantanamo Bay,
right,
at the moment, which I'm sure the U.S. is not really,
right,
considering the exchange. Would you like to discuss that a little bit more?
You know, I don't have any particular information about this possible prisoner exchange, but I do think that this is something that the U.S. has at least been thinking about for a while. Last year, there were some talks between the U.S. and the Taliban, I think, that broke down in part because of U.S. position about possible prisoner exchange. So it's been something that I think has been on the table for some time. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the administration's approach to that is going to be. I mean, I don't really know what their thoughts are. So, but it's I think if nothing else, it's a good excuse to get people to begin talking. which is, depending on your view, either good or bad. But I think that that it's a good basis on which to have some sort of a confidence-building measure that negotiations can take place and that there can be a result in those negotiations. I think that, if nothing else, that's a reason why that's right up front.
Right. And, I mean, I know Karzai was looking at the opening of the office almost as the Taliban sort of opening up their own diplomatic, not really embassy, right, but diplomatic office, and that there was a lot of rub there because right, the Taliban, according to Karzai's government, is not the government of Afghanistan, and
right,
really
right,
doesn't want them to be playing that role.
Right. And that's, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. I don't really think, I think that he was right to be annoyed by some of the symbolic language the Taliban was using. I think there was an issue of a way they were using a flag, and there was a plaque and some other, you know, relatively minor things that were going on at the office, but that were seeming to send a message about some sort of like official nature to it. Like you said, it's not exactly like they were opening an embassy, but that it had some sort of status for them as an office for the government in exile type thing. And so I think it makes perfect sense why he was upset about that. And I think in part because he knows that they're not too eager to speak with him right now. So it's difficult for him to get behind this, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I saw that also because of this flag that the Taliban had raised outside of the Doha office, that there was actually a lot of backlash in Afghanistan from that, that the people of Afghanistan weren't too happy about it, along with Karzai. What, on that line, how do you see the people of Afghanistan, like, what is their reaction to having this Taliban office open and the idea of talks where the Taliban will actually be involved in? Are you there? And we're back. We had a little minor technical difficulty. Sorry about that. As we were talking about before, the question was, with the flag that the Taliban had raised outside of the Doha office, I was wondering what the thoughts of the Afghan people were, because like I said earlier, the flag sort of seemed to incite some anger in Afghanistan. So being in the region, what are your feelings of the Afghans' feelings towards the Taliban being included in peace talks for their country?
Sure. I think you're going to get really wide variation here in Afghanistan. I mean, you have a number of people who are, broadly speaking, actually supportive of the Taliban. And you have people who are just Kabul and some parts of Ghazni. It seems like people are, you know, in Kabul, you're going to get generally more educated, wealthier Afghans sort of opining about this sort of thing. But there's a lot of disgust with the idea that the Taliban would be in negotiations. There's a lot of people here who see them as being basically really lowbrow, uneducated, brutally minded people who are going to try to bring about some kind of level of the same sort of restrictive social regimes and laws that they had when they were in power before. And in Kabul, you're not going to find very much appetite for that. Now, when you're talking to people out in the provinces, depending on where you are, you're going to get a much more nuanced view. But again, it's going to depend on who you talk to. My sense is that in South Ghazni, which is one of the more dangerous parts of the country right now, you have a lot of people in, let's say, Giro district, which is basically infested with Taliban right now. You have reportedly a large number of foreign fighters from Pakistan and elsewhere there right now, and a lot of local fighters who are based there. In a place like that, if you talk to people, obviously you're going to find people who are supportive of the Taliban, but you're also going to find people who are just too terrified to give you an honest opinion about it. And so I think it's very difficult to get people to speak about issues like this with any sort of openness, because there's a lot of fear. And so as far as I can tell, even in these areas where people are quite conservative socially, it's a predominant Pashtun region in South Ghazni, most people are pretty sick of the Taliban. That doesn't mean that they favor the government, but it does mean that they're not looking forward to a time when the Taliban is in control and is able to do things like restrict access to cameras. You know, this is one thing they're real big on in South Ghazni, is collecting up people's cell phones, and if they have videos in the cell phones, and they beat them up and cause problems for them. I mean, there's really not a lot of appetite for that. And so in terms of their enthusiasm for the Taliban as such, it's not that strong. With that being said, they're not all that enthusiastic about the government either. And on the other hand, the idea that there could be an end to the fighting, I think that is something that does appeal to a lot of people. There's just not a sense that this negotiation yet is at a stage where it can promise that, you know?
Interesting. And on that note, when you mentioned Pakistan, I know that there's an understanding that one of the main figures involved in the office opening in Qatar, I believe his name is Tayyip Aga, and okay. I guess you consider him as Mullah Omar's right-hand man. But there seems to be an understanding that Tayyip Aga has a great connection with Pakistan, and that the Taliban in Qatar would not be able to open this office in the region without Pakistan's help. Maybe we could discuss Pakistan's involvement with the Taliban.
Sure. Yeah, I think that it's probably the case that certainly nobody who is powerful within the powerful and well-known within the Taliban movement would be able to easily leave Pakistan without either tacit or explicit approval from someone in the Pakistani government. And anyone who's really well-known, they have a sense at some level of what they're doing. And so I think that it's probably the case that someone as well-known as Tayyip Aga, if he was to try to head to Qatar, sort of unannounced or something, he might run into difficulty. Now, as to what we can say about Pakistan's level of interest or involvement in negotiations based on that, it's sort of hard to know. There's a lot of speculation that part of why the Pakistanis arrested several major Taliban figures in the past is because there was suspicion they were getting involved in peace talks without involving Pakistan. So, you know, it could be. But again, I think it's at this point, you know, when you're talking about spies and the Taliban and sorts of secret ISI negotiations that are going on, who knows? On the surface of it, it makes sense that someone like that, who's well-known, who's powerful in the movement, probably would have had a difficult time getting out of the country, and especially going someplace like Qatar, where there's been talk of beginning a political office, if he didn't have some sort of level of support from the government. Now, in terms of the Pakistani support for the Taliban as such, you know, I think this is a really complicated issue, because obviously there's a distinction that the Pakistanis would like to maintain between the TTP, which is the Pakistani Taliban, and the Afghan Taliban, and all the different groups that fall under the Afghan Taliban umbrella, like the Haqqani Network, the Mansour Network, all these different people. And so for the Pakistanis, because the TTP is sort of anathema to the current Pakistani government and state, they obviously are not supporting the TTP, at least not at any kind of systematic level. That doesn't mean that there's not some rogue person somewhere who's getting involved with them. But I think overall, it's probably safe to say that the Pakistani government is doing what it can to get rid of the TTP. But there are connections, right, between the Afghan Taliban and the PTP and these other groups. And so it's difficult to sort of state definitively exactly what Pakistan's policy on this is, probably because I'm guessing it's not necessarily all that clear to most Pakistanis either, even in the government. And so you have, you know, you have some level of government support for Lashkar-e-Taiba and all these different organizations that traditionally have focused on Kashmir. And you also have some level of resistance against PTP and these other groups that are focused on fighting in Pakistan. They won't get rid of these people. But at the same time, you also have a very long history of relations between groups that began as Mujahideen groups and the ISI. And so the Haqqani Network and any of these other groups that were that have their roots in the 1980s, the Taliban is a little bit different, but again, you know, those the group is made up of former Mujahideen. The ties between the ISI and these organizations are significant and old. And in some ways you could say productive. I think during the 1980s, obviously the Mujahideen needed the support that the ISI, because a lot of the funding and the weaponry, et cetera, was forced to go through the Pakistani government, and the ISI was able to sort of make decisions at some level about which parties got more of that, which parties got less of that, which bases it went to. So there have been some ties there. But to say something like today that, you know, like Mike Mullen did a while ago before he retired, that the Haqqani Network is a veritable arm of the ISI, I mean, it could be true. It's obviously he has much more access to classified information than most of us. But I think even if at some level there is that sort of real link in terms of operational support and control even, I don't know that that's systematic across all of these different groups. I think that you would find that it's going to be pretty particular to which militant group you're talking about and which sorts of missions they're doing. And if it's the kind of thing that's going to sort of highlight the Pakistani involvement, then I think that the Pakistanis are probably not in favor of that, you know? So.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
Looking at this connection between the Taliban and Pakistani government, what do you see are Karzai's government's views of Pakistan having such a, well, trying to have such a hand within Afghanistan's future?
Well, I think that a lot of people here, they have a very deep cognitive bias against anything related to Pakistan. You'll find almost virulent hatred of all things Pakistani in a military or governmental sense. And now when you talk about cultural issues, it's a very different deal. A lot of Afghans, you know, live part of their lives in Pakistan. A lot of Afghans speak Urdu either because they live there or more likely because they watch a lot of Pakistani movies and television. And so I think, you know, so first of all, there's a lot of people here, Karzai probably included to some degree, who are just really just virulently disgusted with Pakistan, and it's seeming, I mean, it seems like the Pakistani government, in their view, has the idea that it has the right and, in fact, the need to control Afghanistan's destiny at some level, right? And mm-hmm. I think they're disgusted with that. So, no, in terms of what they're able to do about that, I mean, not much. It's difficult to get leverage over Pakistan on this issue because Afghanistan, in terms of the economy, is completely dependent on imports that travel by land from Karachi up through Peshawar or up towards Quetta and then on to Kandahar. So it's a difficult position for them.
So they sort of need them, but they also don't want them. It's sort of a love-hate but need relationship almost.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that if you talk to Afghans about Pakistan, they make a lot of really offensive remarks and jokes. I mean, there's a is a common thing in southern, well, I guess, maybe it's in Kandahar, certainly in eastern Pashto, a lot of people mistake the letter P for the letter F. And so it's very easy to mispronounce Pakistan as something much more offensive, for example. and so that's, they make lots of jokes like that. In fact, in a lot of eastern Afghanistan, especially in Ghazni, when they talk about Punjabi Taliban coming and fighting in the area, they call them Turkuni, which means black ass, basically. And so there's a lot of like virulent, almost like racist hatred, actually quite openly racist in many instances, hatred of the part of Pakistan that is interfering in Afghanistan. And this is actually becoming a problem for the Taliban, because there have been these recent border clashes, especially in Nangarhar and elsewhere, with Pakistani border forces over, because there's issues obviously with the recognition of the international border, where is it? But because this is such an important nationalist issue, now there's obviously a large number of Pakistanis fighting with the Taliban here, with the Afghan Taliban in Afghanistan, and the local people really hate that. they see that as being somehow like a betrayal of Afghanistan, that you would bring Punjabis and even Waziristanis, very close culturally to Afghans, that you would bring those to Afghanistan to fight. That somehow is becoming a major political issue, at least in parts of Ghazni. There's a lot of hatred for Pakistan here, but that makes it difficult to do anything, right? Because what we need is sort of like reasoned dialogue, and that's hard to come by.
Right. I mean, do you see then, since there is this animosity, but on the other hand, as you were saying, Afghanistan sort of needs Pakistan and vice versa. I mean, do you see that really beneficial talks between the two, and maybe the two countries working together would be a good thing for for Afghanistan? Do you see that could be a case, or is that basically never going to happen, with at least not in the near future, with what you see there on the ground?
I mean, I have no idea. I could say that my best guess is that right now the trust deficit is so enormous between Afghanistan and Pakistan that it's difficult to imagine anything in the short term where there's actual, real productive talks that aren't sort of, that don't take place because of necessity. It could be that both governments get backed into a corner and end up having to make some kind of a deal. And that's certainly possible. But in terms of there being, a real meeting of the minds, there's just such a complete deficit of trust, it's difficult to see that happening. It's like imagine, in the U.S. you have people, the pro-abortion and the, well, not pro-abortion, pro-life, no, I'm sorry, I'm getting myself confused here. Pro-choice and pro-life activists getting together and sitting down and having a productive conversation. That's a very difficult thing to imagine, right?
Right.
Or like on the gun control debate, where you have people who are, Second Amendment activists, and you have people who are, in favor of controlling handguns and everything. And if you want to get those people at the same table, there's just so much name-calling and hatred and lack of understanding. It's difficult to see it happening. It could happen at some point. I don't know that that'll happen anytime soon. And now, like I said, that doesn't mean that there won't be productive talks. I think that the chances are that necessity is going to invent some kind of a solution of some sort over the next few years. But the thing is that Pakistan has had such a really nefarious influence in the region for so long that everybody's suspicious of Pakistan. And, in some ways Pakistan has also been a victim, but the fact is that most people in the region don't see it that way. They see themselves as being victimized by Pakistani involvement. And so it's difficult to see there being any kind of short-term real trust building up. I don't know. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see it.
And so on that note, with the tension between these two neighbors, How do you see the United States? What could their involvement be to finding a better peaceful resolution for the region? Like
Sorry, what
how
was the last sentence for finding a better route for the region?
peaceful resolution to the region.
Okay. Yeah. This is that's a great question. This is a place where the problems, they on the surface of it, they seem really intractable. I think that right now there are a number of things that we're doing that are counterproductive. I think that building in the long term, building a civil government in Pakistan that is able to begin to take more control over its foreign policy decisions and military policy decisions, I think that is a hugely important step. I think that confidence building measures between Pakistan and India are very important. I think that Kashmir and the fear of sort of a war to end all wars between Pakistan and India are still, those are still issues which are they're understood to be at the basis of a lot of what's going on in Afghanistan in terms of Pakistan's decision making here. And I think that until that begins to be sort of, at least until the rhetoric begins to move back from the eventuality of state on state war, it's difficult to see Pakistan making a lot of different calculations. But who knows, right? I do think that what we're doing right now with the drone campaign is, we can argue about its effectiveness in terms of taking out high value targets in these militant organizations. But I think that it's politically, it's radioactive. It's something which creates a lot of animosity towards the U.S. And because at some level we have to involve the Pakistanis and or the Yemenis or whoever it is in the idea that we might be doing these strikes, that doesn't mean that they publicly are going to announce that. And so the Pakistanis get to then go out and make hay politically, I would say, saying, look at what the Americans are doing. They're killing Pakistanis again. This is so terrible, even though they may have just approved this sort of program. And so I think that, building some sort of confidence between Pakistan and India, which is a gargantuan Herculean task, is an important thing that has to happen. I think that building a society, a civil society, a civil government in Pakistan, which is something they have to do, but that hopefully we can help support, that is able to start taking charge of foreign policy decisions, military policy decisions, I think that's a huge component of it. I think that there's a dawning realization in some parts of Pakistan, and some people have known for a long time, obviously, but I think that there's maybe beginning to be some more conversations there about the danger of the sort of Islamically based militancy for Pakistan itself. And I think that's an important conversation, that once you start to get some people, a significant number of people there who are able to openly question the utility of supporting all these militant groups, the utility of funding groups to fight Kashmir, et cetera, I think that's a huge step. And in terms of what we can do for the region, I mean, this is just, I don't know. I mean, I think the U.S. really has, I tend to argue that we don't actually have that much ability to fix things here. I think we have a lot of ability to ruin things. I think we could screw things up big time. I don't think that there's a lot that we can do at this point to fix it. I do think that there's some stuff we can do at the margins, and there's some stuff we can do in the center. Like, I think that the drone campaign in Pakistan is one that there needs to be some serious public dialogue about whether or not this is helping us, which is beginning to take place in the U.S., but I think needs to be more robust. But yeah.
That's interesting. And so, what do you find the feeling is with US pulling out of Afghanistan? And like you mentioned earlier, the thought that the Karzai government or whatever government you're going to have in Afghanistan What is the feeling on, like, how would I describe this? What do people feel like? What are their strong points of how do they feel about this government taking over and their power to do so, the confidence in their government doing that? What is the feeling locally of, are they ready for that? I mean, do the people of Afghanistan feel like they're ready to take their country and, like you said, build it up, or is there still worries about this topic?
I think there are a lot of worries, and I think that they're, in some ways they're based in history. I think in some ways they're based in misreadings of history. I think a lot of people in Afghanistan and outside of Afghanistan are concerned that you're going to have a return to the violence of the mid-1990s when the U.S. leaves. And I think that although that's possible, I think that we're pretty far from that. And I think that there's a lot of sort of ahistorical thinking which is going into to drumming up that fear, which is actually kind of counterproductive. And I think in fact to answer this question in part and also related back to the question you just asked about what the U.S. can do to begin to promote peace, et cetera, and long-term stability in the region, I think we have got to come out sooner than we have with more precise commitments about what exactly we're going to be doing here over the next 5, 10 years. We've been very slow about this, and I understand politically why. In many ways, it's a difficult issue for the Obama administration. They don't want to leave a lot of soldiers here. The United States doesn't have a lot of appetite for Afghanistan at this point. A lot of people have been hearing about the corruption and the failure of development, and they're just disgusted with it, and they just don't care anymore. But the fact is that we have drug out this question of how many people will we leave here and what will their roles be for so long, years really, that people have long ago begun to act based on the uncertainty around what the U.S. is going to do or not do. Because there's not yet any certainty, a lot of people are hedging their bets. And, it's hard to really know how much of this is true, but you hear a lot of things about General Dostum and Akka in the north, beginning to maneuver with the old Jamiat groups and these different people in the north, the former Northern Alliance. You hear a lot about that, and I'm sure at some level, I mean, they would be idiots to not begin making some preparations. And they were warlords before. I don't know why they wouldn't begin start pulling the same sorts of stunts they did before. So I think that some of that's probably true, and that's dangerous, right? And so because there's not a lot of sense of what the heck the U.S. is going to be doing here. Is the U.S. going to actually follow through on its promise to not forget Afghanistan, or is it going to be kind of like a, make the house of cards and try and get out of the room before it falls down situation? Because people don't know yet, there's a great deal of fear and uncertainty. And in many ways, I think it's easy to overlook the progress that's been made. I mean, there've been a lot of great basic success stories in terms of number of children in school. In the last 10 years, you've seen a massive rise in numbers of children in school, girls getting educated, things like that. But in terms of people's trust in the current government to be able to actually do anything, to control anything, I don't think it's very strong in some areas. I mean, for example, I mentioned Gero before. Gero District is neighbors Andar and some other parts of South Ghazni that are pretty famous. And Gero, basically, they just got a new district governor there, and the new district governor barely leaves the district compound. I mean, the idea that there is a government in Kabul doesn't really have a major impact on the day-to-day life of people in places like Gero. And there's a lot of places like that in Afghanistan. Now, with that being said, there's other parts of South Ghazni where the government's becoming much stronger. And so I think it really varies. You get pretty different stories about people's level of trust and interest in the government based on what they've seen. But there's not a lot of appetite for the corruption. There's not a lot of appetite for the arrogance and the just wanton ravaging of resources. People are pretty disgusted with that, and that's really been one of the best things going for the Taliban for a while now. The Karzai government has issues with corruption, and that makes it easy for the Taliban to point at themselves and say, "Hey, listen, we're honest."
Right. So it sounds like even though you have this government that has been set up in Afghanistan under Karzai, it sounds like the country still, as you were mentioning about the mayor, it still has a very strong tribal system going on. And with that said, if the government's not fully involved in most of the country, if the Taliban came to the table in peace talks, their influence potentially could be quite strong because they are spread throughout all of the areas in Afghanistan, tribal areas, etc. So I'm sure they have a much more further reach in the country. I mean, is that something that you see potentially worrying?
I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned something important there about tribes. I think that this is something that can work for and against the Taliban, or for and against the Karzai government. In areas like Ghazni, the tribes are not as strong as they used to be. If you go to Khost or Paktia or Paktika, in general, the tribes there are extremely strong. And the traditional modes of justice and conflict resolution are much, much stronger in these upland mountainous areas of eastern Afghanistan than they are in other parts. And so the tribes can actually be a tool for moving the government's agenda forward or the Taliban's agenda forward. If the tribes are strong, then it becomes a locus for political activity that you don't have in a place like Kandahar, where the tribes are present, but it's not as clear that people are necessarily going to follow what their tribal elders say at the Shura meeting, you know? So I think that, you know, I wouldn't say that the government has no reach in most of the country. I don't think that's quite the case. I do think that there are isolated areas where they have very little reach. Mm. And in those areas, like Giro, it's extremely difficult to talk to people, to work there. So who really knows what people think there? My sense is that from talking to people who live and work near there, that in places like Giro, where the government has no reach, people, it's interesting, right? Because when there's not a lot of fighting between the Taliban and the government, in many ways that can sometimes make the life of the local people easier. So if the Taliban is in control of an area, people learn what their rules are and they abide by them, and it's fine. They don't necessarily like it, but it's manageable. Whereas if the area is contested, then there's a lot of violence. And so even as the government is expanding its control, especially through the ALP and these, you know, building new ANA units, but especially the Afghan local police, if the government is expanding its control into parts of Afghanistan where they don't necessarily have a lot of reach right now, then, you know, in some ways, that actually makes the life of the local people much, much worse initially, because there's more fights between the Taliban and the government. And so it's sort of a paradox, right? Mm-hmm. The government wants to expand its control, but in order to do that, it means that people in areas where the Taliban are in control are going to see more violence, which is not something they're going to like, because their family members are going to get killed. There's going to be civilian casualties. A lot of times, usually, honestly, it's the Taliban that ends up committing those civilian casualties. But in the end, the Taliban and the government end up getting blamed for it equally, if not the government getting solely blamed for it, because people are too afraid to publicly blame the Taliban for something like that. So it's, you know, it's not that the government has no control. It's just that in areas where they have less control, it's difficult. It's not that it can't change. It is changing. It has changed. But it's difficult to see a situation where the people are confident about this government's ability to to do anything after 2014 because I haven't done much so far.
Interesting. And to sort of wrap up the conversation, we always like to give our special guest on the show sort of an option to sort of have a last say. Is there anything that you would like to touch upon?
So any topic at all, huh?
Yeah, exactly. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think that it's easy to get too pessimistic about the situation here. I think that Afghanistan is going to continue to exist as a country. I think that the people of Afghanistan, in many ways, are waking up to things that are going to make some fundamental tectonic shifts in the face of this society in the next 20 years. There's much, much broader recognition of the importance of good education here now. You know, even in areas that are very conservative. In fact, tribes who I've worked before in Paktia, they were asking me for girls' schools. You know, this isn't something that people know about, but even in areas where the tribes are very strong, the Pashtun tribes, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're trying to live in some sort of backwards, antiquated world. And so I think that the future of Afghanistan, it will, I think, eventually get better. The question of what the path is that takes them there is a frightening one. I hope it doesn't go in the direction that some people are afraid it will. But frankly, to be honest, I'm not all that pessimistic. I think that it's going to continue to be very violent here for a while, but I don't see a situation where it devolves into complete chaos and civil war, and I don't see a return to the era of the Taliban. I think that over the long term, no matter what happens in the next 5 years, no matter how much, you know, uproar there is as the U.S. sort of slowly draws down or precipitously draws down, whichever it is, I think that in the end, the story here is going to be a good one, I hope. And I think that it's easy to lose that. But if you look at things like the number of children who are being educated now, and the amount of access to information about the outside world, and the growing number of Afghans who speak English, I mean, if nothing else, I mean, there's been a massive amount of contact between the United States, Western Europe, Canada, Australia, et cetera, and Afghans. And so there's huge numbers of Afghans, not just in the diaspora living in D.C. and Northern Virginia, but actual Afghans living here who speak perfect English, who are well-educated, who understand, you know, politics very well. And I think that the future of this country could be reasonably bright. I think it may take a while, but so I'd like to sound a hopeful note.
That's fantastic. I mean, with every transition, there's always going to be many roadblocks, but hopefully this transition for Afghanistan, like you said, turns into a fantastically positive story. And we wish all the best for Afghanistan and its people. And I thank you, Kevin, for being on the show. And we wish you the best over there in Afghanistan as well. And stay safe. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.